From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley. Today, actor, producer, and director Griffin Dunn. His memoir, The Friday Afternoon Club, is about growing up as part of a family of storytellers who were in love with the idea of fame and celebrity. He'll tell us about his own complicated relationship with fame after becoming famous for his breakout roles in An American Werewolf in London and Martin Scorsese's After Hours, and what he's learned from his father, Dominic Dunn, a Hollywood producer and frequent writer for Vanity Fair, and his late aunt, Joan Didion. Griffin Dunn also reveals how the brutal killing of his younger sister Dominique, a rising star in her own right at the time of her death, brought his family closer together. And David Bianculli has an appreciation of Tom Lehrer, who wrote satirical topical songs like Vatican Rag and Masochism Tango. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley. As the son of the late writer and television producer Dominic Dunn, Griffin Dunn grew up in the center of old Hollywood. His father's lavish parties made for countless stories about the rich and famous. Sean Connery saved him from drowning when he was 8. His first babysitter was Elizabeth Montgomery, the actor who played Samantha in Bewitched. And he shared one of his first apartments with his best friend, the late Carrie Fisher. But at the heart of Griffin's memoir, The Friday Afternoon Club, is also a story of tragedy and how the Dunn family overcame it. Mental illness, addiction, a closeted father, and the death of Griffin's sister, Dominique, who was killed by an ex-boyfriend in 1982 when she was just 22 years old. Griffin Dunn began working in Hollywood as an actor. His breakout roles were in the 1981 comedy An American Werewolf in London and the 1985 Martin Scorsese-directed movie After Hours, which Griffin co-produced. His most recent work includes roles in This Is Us, Succession, and The Girls on the Bus. Griffin Dunn is also a director. In 2017, he directed the Netflix documentary The Center Will Not Hold about his aunt, the late writer Joan Didion. Dunn's memoir is now out in paperback, and I spoke with him last year. Griffin Dunn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, Griffin, this memoir is as much about you as it is about the famous people who make up your life and your family. And the stories are both hilarious and at times pretty dark. And I'll say even the dark points, though, that you write about, some of them you write with a tinge of humor. I'm just wondering, had you been cataloging these stories, knowing that you wanted to write a book like this?
I certainly have. You know, at some point, I'd hear myself be telling stories to friends over dinner. And at a certain point, I started to get home and I'd think, that was a pretty good story. I'm going to make a note of that. And I would just let them pile up with, I'd be a decade or so away from beginning a book. But it was in the back of my mind. And they weren't just stories about me and my misfortunes, and that were usually always funny, but also about my grandparents and great-grandparents, who also led incredible lives filled with scandal and infidelity and a lot of humor as well.
You go way back, as you said. You go back to your great-grandparents and your grandparents laying out their arrival to the United States and your family, your immediate family, consisting of your father, Dominic Dunn, your mother, Ellen, your brother, Alex, and your late sister, Dominique. And the orbit that surrounded all of you all, too. You guys were living in Beverly Hills, and your father, he'd hold these parties, as you mentioned. How would you describe these parties?
They were all different kinds of parties. Sometimes people would come over in black tie, and there'd only be about 16 people in black tie with a little orchestra my father hired, you know, a little string quartet to play, and they would sit around a long dinner table and talk very, very loud. And we would be, at some point before the adults got too drunk, we would be brought downstairs, my brother, sister, and I, in matching bathrobes and pajamas, and my sister in a little, like, Victorian bonnet on her head, a nightcap. And we'd come in, and all the adults would go, ooh, and ah, and aren't they adorable?
Yeah.
And my brother and I would bow good night, and my sister would curtsy, and they would all clap and think that was delightful. And then quite a few years later, I end up working with Dennis Hopper, who was at that time quite young and a guest in our home, and well before he did Easy Rider. And we were working together, and he sort of stared off and said, yeah, I was at your parents' house when you kids came downstairs. I thought that was the saddest thing I ever saw.
How did you interpret that? What do you think he meant by it?
I think he was right. I mean, you know, my father was before he became really into himself and the man that we know, he was a very kind of skittish person whose priorities about having famous people to his home and giving parties and You know, he would keep scrapbooks of the pictures he took of all the famous people who came to the house and the telegrams, the accepting his dinner parties. And I look back on it, and it was kind of embarrassing.
As an early executive, what types of things was your dad doing in Hollywood in those early days in television?
Well, his first job in the earliest days of television was on the Howdy Doody show, which, for those who don't know, Howdy was a puppet, a very cheerful puppet. And Dad was the stage manager, and it was his job to place him, Howdy, on a stool before the show went live. But from then, he went on to kind of classier fare, and he was with Playhouse 90. And that's where he met many of the people that end up being in his party, where he's the stage manager, you know, laying down the tape for the blocking. And he would meet Humphrey Bogart, Paul Newman, James Dean, Arthur Penn, all of these remarkable, who became incredibly famous for their talent, you know, later on in life. These were their earliest parts of their career. And then he became a vice president of a company called Four Star. That's when we moved to Los Angeles. And it was a very classy production company within CBS.
You're very young during these Hollywood years. One of the things that you would do as a kid is that you like to exaggerate and tell these elaborate stories. And I found this really interesting because it seems like there were so many true stories that you could have told that were just as fantastical. Why did you feel like you needed to exaggerate, especially when it came to telling stories about your father and who he was? Because you would tell your classmates some tall tales about him.
Yes, I would. And you know, a part of me as a boy was a little embarrassed of my dad, that he wasn't as athletic. You couldn't play baseball with him, and the kind of things he was concerned about. He was always funny. He always made me laugh. He had a very dark, funny sense of humor that I inherited. But, you know, my best friends, I went to a very kind of Hollywood school where everybody's parents were in the business. And they knew my dad was, you know, he just couldn't throw a baseball to save his life. They would make fun of me, and they'd say, my dad could lick your dad with one hand tied behind his back. And I came back with, well, he will. I'd throw his name right in the ring as soon as he gets out of jail. They go, what? Yeah, he's in prison. Why? He went, he robbed a bank. And, you know, this lie got around school so quickly that the principal of the school called my father. And I had this incredibly uncomfortable moment where my dad, when he came home from work, he was mystified. And he said, is that something you wish I would do, Griffin? And I was so embarrassed. But he didn't pursue it because I think he knew I was a little embarrassed of him. It was a very tough moment for both of us.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Griffin Dunne. He's written a new book called The Friday Afternoon Club, a memoir about his life and complicated family, who dealt with significant traumas, including mental illness and addiction, and the murder of his sister. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and today we're talking to actor, producer, director, and author Griffin Dunne. He's written a new memoir titled The Friday Afternoon Club, a family memoir, which delves into the story of the Dunne family. His father, Dominic Dunne's life and career as a TV producer and frequent writer for Vanity Fair, his closeted sexuality, and the impacts that all of that had on everyone, including Griffin. The book also delves into the death of Griffin's sister, Dominique, who was killed by an ex-boyfriend in 1982 when she was 22 years old. I want to ask you a little bit about your mom, because your mother, Ellen Dunne, was in her later life known as an activist. After your sister was killed, she founded the organization Justice for Homicide Victims. She was actually recognized by President George H.W. Bush
'89
for her work. Your parents seemed not the opposite of each other, but but maybe an unlikely couple. What do you think attracted them to each other?
My mother had a lot of class. She was an only child, grew up on a ranch in Arizona on the border of Mexico, a town called Nogales. But she was sent away to boarding school, all-girls school called Farmington. She was incredibly well-read, loved classical music, and came to New York, and she was a model, and she was very, very beautiful. You know, my dad fell in love with her on first sight, and he just was enthralled by her beauty. And what she saw in him was, one, he was a really funny guy, and he knew a lot of stuff about New York and gangsters and movie stars, and you know, unlike any man that she'd ever met. I mean, she grew up in Arizona. She went out with guys who rode in rodeos. And my father, you know, he knew Oleg Cassini's and, you know, could make references to, you know, everything from movies to fashion. And I think she just found him fascinating.
Until she didn't.
Until she didn't.
Yeah.
That fascination with celebrity and partying and movie stars got very, very tired for her. And, you know, he was, he's written about this, so I'm not, Dad was very frank about his personality and character in these years. You know, he was drinking a great deal, and he was getting very sloppy, and he was getting a little mean in his gossip, and people were really turning him away. And he didn't
because
see
that's
that.
The thing that your dad loved to do is he would pick apart. He would gossip all the time. They'd go to parties. He'd come home. And on the way home, he'd be talking about everything that happened at the party.
Absolutely. Just recounting everything. And again, it's storytelling, too. He would just weave and describe an incredible dinner with, you know, Alfred Hitchcock was over there and Jimmy Stewart. And she just started to not really give a damn about this.
There's this moment that you write about that I wanted to just ask you about that, like, maybe speaks to your relationship with your mom, where in the announcement of your parents' divorce, they sat you and your brother and sister down, and because your mom said, "I'm leaving you, and so we have to tell the kids," sat all of you down, and after the announcement was made, the kids are crying, you put your hands over your face, you're kind of crying, but then you look out of your fingers and you and your mom's eyes lock.
Yeah. I was faking
it. And that's
a
significant moment for you.
Yes, yeah. It is.
What did it represent? What was that unspoken thing you all were saying to each other?
It was a kind of relief. There was a certain tyranny and he would lose his temper a lot at that point in his life. It was exhausting. And being the oldest, I was empathetic to my mother. I could just feel her drift further and further away. And in a way from the family. And it was kind of startling to me that I was losing a connection with her. I've always understood my mother. She was sometimes, particularly toward the end of her life, a few words.
But because she suffered from MS.
She suffered
towards the
from
end of
MS.
Her life, she could not talk anymore.
And this is before she was diagnosed, but soon would be soon after. And I felt terrible that my brother and sister were crying, that I felt terrible about myself, that I didn't feel anything. I felt this kind of relief, and I felt guilty about the relief. So I pretended to cry, and I covered my eyes. And as you said, through one slit of my fingers, I saw my mother, whose hands was also covering her eyes in grief and tears. And I saw, both of us saw each other's totally dry eyes. And we both knew we were faking it.
You spent a lot of time thinking about your parents, your mother's choice to marry him, divorce him, also your dad's closeted homosexuality, which you actually didn't confirm until his deathbed, even though there were signs there. One of his first productions was the 1970 film The Boys in the Band, which is one of the earliest movies centering queer characters.
Mm-hmm.
Does it seem obvious to you looking back when you put it all together?
Oh, completely. And, you know, in the years, even since his passing, he had, I think, a fairly robust gay life that remained closeted.
Did your mom know when they were married?
I don't know the moment that she knew. I just know that after the divorce, I became her drinking partner. Now, I was not drinking, although she gave me a glass of wine, maybe. I was now in my early teens. But she would drink to excess, enough to sort of overshare with a young kid, with her son. And it was then that she told me, you know, that this trip that I remember so fondly with my dad and this other guy who came with us, who I thought was hilarious, who reminded me of one of the characters, a character I liked very much in Flipper, the older brother. Mom was a little bombed and overshared that that guy was my dad's lover. Now, my reaction wasn't shocked. I actually was honored that I was thought of as being so grown up as to be
could
confided
handle it,
in,
that you
like
could
a grown
handle
up.
It. Yeah. Well, thinking about your dad's sexuality, one of the things we actually learn about you in this book is that you were girl crazy. I mean, sex was always on your mind. Readers will get out a kick out of that. Like, I'll let them read all those juicy details you write about in the book. But yeah. I was wondering...
Well, that's what teenagers thought about at the time. Every seven seconds, they say.
How was it for you to write that stuff? I mean, you had to go back to your teenage mind to get there, right?
I did. Yeah. I traveled there quite easily. and I was indeed girl crazy. I thought about girls all the time. You know, long before... I could, you know, actually get them. I was in awe of them. They intimidated me. You know,
I was just wondering how your sexuality, your understanding of your sexuality, was also impacted by your father's repression of his orientation. And I say that because you hint at it.
Well, I had been deflowered when I was 13 by a girl who was 16, and always had these girlfriends. And at the time, I had a girlfriend who I eventually married as a teenager as well in Tijuana, but that's another story. And Dad always left his apartment unlocked. And I walked in on him with a guy who turned out to be, you know, his boyfriend, lover. And Dad freaked out that I saw. And it was so clear what happened, what was going on. The guy didn't even have a shirt on. And he said, oh, this man is my valet. I've hired him to be. You almost wanted to laugh out loud. You know, we got out on the street, and this girl could be quite cruel at times too. And we both saw the same thing. And she said, so your dad is gay. Well, if he's gay, I wonder if that means you're gay. Now, that was like a virus that went in my head. I mean, I actually, you know, I was 17 or 18. Mm-hmm. I thought it was hereditary. I thought, you know, and I didn't know. I hadn't really thought about my own sexuality as that being a preference, but I felt I had to find out because I was, it scared me so much. And by the way, my mother had lots of gay friends, and you know, there was a gay general who produced Patton, the movie Patton, and he taught me how to salute. And I found out at an early age that his practical husband was a publicist, and they lived in houses next door to each other. I knew that story when I was 11 or 12. It didn't make any impression on me. I didn't find that unusual. I just didn't think it would, literally the way I thought, this would touch me if I'd been touched by it. And so I went over and, you know, and kind of like had
relations.
Uncomfortable, weird, you know, sort of sex with the valet when my father was out of town. And the guy said to me, Griffin, I got to tell you, you don't have what it takes to be a homo. and I went, okay, I found out. Okay, I think I'm okay.
That's something else, though, you know, to say I'm going to try it to actually confirm for myself or not whether I am.
You know, when I got to that part in the book, I went, God, I really did that? I can't believe I did that. My young self really did that. I kind of admired it. And then when I wrote it down, and it was, you know, I would send my editor, John Burnham Schwartz, these, you know, clumps of pages as I went along. And I remember he went, wow, you really said
right.
that? You sure you're going to do this? And I went, yeah, what the hell?
You wanted to keep it in there.
Yeah.
Can you describe the boys in the band? Because for all of its groundbreaking nature, it was about self-loathing, that it was all about suffering.
And at the same time, it was also hilariously funny. But at the core of it was self-loathing that was assuaged with lots of alcohol at that party. You know, I went to school in the East Coast at that time while that movie was being filmed. And I went to the set several times. And, you know, it was a remarkable movie for Billy Friedkin to be making, too. What a bold choice to make, you know, as a young director. I think it was only his second movie.
And your dad was the executive producer.
And my dad was the executive producer. Again, at that age, I wasn't really thinking, oh, he was. I found out he was in love with one of the cast members, a guy named Frederick Combs, who later became a very close friend of mine, who told me, you know, about how heartbroken my father was that his love wasn't reciprocated. And of the cast of eight, I believe five died of AIDS, and Frederick was one of them.
That's devastating.
And, you know, toward the very end of his life, he called me, and I could hear how sick he was. And there was all this noise in the background. And I said, "Where are you?" And he went, "I'm in L.A. County Hospital." I went, "What are you doing there?" And his insurance had run out, his SAG insurance. And I was producing a movie at the time. We were just about to go into production, and we gave him a job as an actor, which, of course, he couldn't fulfill. And his insurance kicked in right away.
So that he could have insurance.
And he ended up dying with a hospice care, and he died in his own bed in his own home.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Griffin Dunne. He's written a new book called The Friday Afternoon Club, a memoir about his life and complicated family. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. I'm Tanya Mosley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley. And today we're talking to actor Griffin Dunne. His breakout roles were in the 1981 comedy An American Werewolf in London and the Martin Scorsese-directed film After Hours, which Dunne co-produced. He's written a new book titled The Friday Afternoon Club, a family memoir, which delves into the story of the Dunne family, growing up among larger-than-life characters in Hollywood. His dad was Dominic Dunne, a Hollywood producer and frequent writer for Vanity Fair. The book is also about how his family dealt with tragedy, mental illness, a closeted father, and the death of Griffin's sister, Dominique, who was killed by John Sweeney, an ex-boyfriend, in 1982 when she was 22 years old. I actually want to talk about your sister, Dominique, for a moment. Who was Dominique? What role did she fill in your family?
Well, being the only girl and the youngest, she was by far the favorite of my parents and my brother and I. You know, just we were old enough to remember her coming back from the hospital. My mother had lost two girls before
Oh.
And I was in the car with her when she miscarried a little boy. And she was fully pregnant but bleeding. And she drove herself with me in the passenger seat, which I remember. That was another, you're talking about my relationship with my mother, that was another hugely bonding moment for us, even though I was only about 4 years old. And she said, "You're very brave, Griffin," when she left me in the car as she was taken in, and I waited for my father. And then she lost another girl. So when she came into our lives, it was like, oh, my God. And my mom, first thing she was, "I can't believe I finally got a little girl. I finally got a daughter." And she, you know, she grew up. She was quite a bossy little thing. And my dad called her Little Miss Muffet. And she, you know, loved animals, you know, just from the get-go. And my brother and I would just, like, compete to do things for her. And she knew... my father was gay long before we would find out, and she never told us. She was, that was like between, and my dad knew that she knew because he had a relationship with a friend of hers for 20-something years, and which we never knew. I never knew until Dad was on his deathbed. And when she decided to become an actress, I was in New York doing everything but being an actor and being rejected and, you know, on the border of being a bitter guy. She said she wanted to be an actress. I went, "Oh, God, Dominique, don't do that." And I think about a week or two later, she auditioned, one of her very first auditions, for a TV movie called Diary of a Teenage Hitchhiker. Mm-hmm. And she played the teenage hitchhiker. Mm-hmm. She was number one on the call sheet. And she was off and running.
She went on to then play the role of the older sister in Poltergeist. And as you said, you have no doubt that she would have been a successful actor. Her killing was one of the most devastating things to happen to your family. It also helped your father find his voice after a pretty tough time that he was dealing with after leaving Hollywood, after going broke and trying to find himself as a writer. After her death, he became known as Dominic Dunn, the father of a murdered daughter. And he wrote quite extensively about her and other murders and just became another persona. It propelled his second act. And you felt conflicted by it. Can you say more about that confliction?
You know, before Dad and I went to New York, on his last night in New York, he went to a dinner party at the urging of a wonderful journalist and friend of his who stuck by him named Marie Brenner. She just kind of bullied him into coming to this dinner. And she sat him next to Tina Brown, who was in New York with the hopes of taking over Vanity Fair, which she was going to resurrect. And they sat next to each other, and he told her where he was going to Los Angeles for the trial of the killer of his daughter and how little he knew about the judicial system, how he'd never been in a courtroom. And he was scared, and he didn't know what he was going into. And he was worried about how the trial would affect my mother's health, who was now at this point in a wheelchair from MS. And as Tina listened, she said, "Keep a diary. And if I get this job, you will be one of the first people I publish." Mm-hmm. And he did. And he turned it in. And it was more than a diary. It was an essay about what a family goes through if they are on the side of the prosecution and prosecuting the person that killed their family member.
And we should say that John Sweeney, he was sentenced to manslaughter, and then he was incarcerated in a medium security prison. He only served 3 years for your sister's death.
Yeah, 3.5, actually, but who cares? You know, it was a ridiculous sentence. So Dad wrote about this, and he was in Oregon licking his wounds and having lost all of his money and having going to AA meetings every day. His mission was also to be a writer. That's what he most wanted to be. And when this happened and he came to Los Angeles for this trial and he wrote this article, that's when he found his voice. You know, and from the time he turned that in, he became a crime reporter, but not just any crime reporter. He became a reporter bringing such a unique tragic experience to what he was writing about, that when he wrote about O.J. Simpson, he never let the reader forget the Simpsons or the Browns. And when he wrote about Phil Spector, you know, he let people know Lana Clarkson wasn't some third-rate actress who the rest of the media were portraying. And he's always had written for the side of the victim. He's always been empathetic.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Griffin Dunn. He's written a new memoir called The Friday Afternoon Club about his life and how his family dealt with significant traumas, mental illness, addiction, a closeted father, and the death of his sister. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, presenting Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the scandalous true story of England's infamous Mitford sisters. Streaming this and more original series at BritBox.com. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR.
This is Fresh Air, and today we're talking to actor, producer, and author Griffin Dunn. He's written a new memoir titled The Afternoon Club. I want to play a clip from one of your breakout roles, After Hours, which came out in 85. It was directed by Martin Scorsese, and in it you play Paul, who meets a woman named Marcy, played by Rosanna Arquette. You all meet at a cafe, and later that night she invites you to her apartment, and on the way there, your character loses a $20 bill he was going to use to pay for the cab. He meets Marcy at her home. It gets really weird in the apartment. And feeling like something is wrong with her, he basically dips. He leaves the first chance he gets. But after a series of events that make it impossible for him to get home, he comes back to Marcy. And in this scene I'm going to play, he's talking to her as she's lying in the bed with her eyes closed.
I'm sorry. I don't know what happened to me. I don't know. Maybe the timing's just off or something. But, I think I just better go. Okay. Marcy? Marcy? My... Oh, Jesus!
Marcy. Oh, God! Breathe! Breathe!
That was Griffin Dunn as Paul in the 1985 film After Hours. And what he actually encounters is Marcy has taken drugs to kill herself when she's knocked out in the bed. What did you learn from that time in working with Scorsese and directing?
He made it look like so much fun. I learned that if you're prepared enough, which he was, the most prepared director I've ever worked with, if you're prepared enough, you can go off script, you can change the game plan, you just have time to work with just the directors. And I loved his direction would sometimes be so so unexpected, you know, that there was a scene where Rosanna Arquette as Marcy is telling this, you know, terrible time about her husband, about him screaming, "Surrender, Dorothy." And she was doing it very, very kind of seriously, take after take. And Marty came up to her and said, I don't think you would laugh during this, would you? She went, no, God, no. Am I laughing? She goes, no, no, but make sure you don't laugh. Well, off she went. you know, and he, to get my looks of, you know, kind of shock and stuff, there was a cardboard box filled with broken glass in it and a big rock. And he'd have the prop guy, Tommy Allen, standing next to him when the rat trap would go off. He wanted to see me jump. He would take the rock and throw it into the glass and made this horrible sound, and my spine would shoot up, and I'd just fly off in the air. He would just think of things off the top of his head to sort of get reactions.
It's almost, though, like you were a reluctant actor, though, because you actually turned down a lot of roles following After Hours. What was that reluctance about?
I think I had a complicated relationship with success, and certainly with fame, because with fame, one, it brought back all that kind of the importance of being famous was when I was brought up in the house. Like, you know, the way people talked about celebrities, like they were like celebrities and then everybody else were a bunch of nobodies. But there was also, they came with it, a great deal of attention, like unwarranted attention.
Was it a kind of self-sabotage? Because, I mean, you were offered some really, some really powerful roles like Sex, Lies, and Videotape. You turned that down. But then you decided to do roles like a talking penis.
I know. I know. Well, I get it. That's exactly what I get into. I just felt kind of lost. I felt lost about my decisions. And, you know, every actor at some point, usually early in their career, they think the entire world is waiting to see what decision you make next. And that, you know, it will cause great controversy and affect the economy if, you know, you take a crappy job and or do a movie that's a flop. So it paralyzes a lot of people. And I was particularly paralyzed with that. I felt much more comfortable producing movies that I had developed the story with and that I knew where it was going, that I knew was a good movie, that was attracting top directors and top actors. That at least I knew I was doing really good work. When I was, my decision-making about being an actor that just involved me, I wasn't so good at that kind of decisions.
You produced a documentary about your Aunt Joan Didion, 2017, about her life and career. It's called Joan Didion, The Center Will Not Hold. And I want to play a clip from it. It's the two of you. You're looking at old photographs and you remind your Aunt Joan about the time when you and your brother, Alex, first met her as children after your uncle married her. Let's listen.
Do you remember meeting me for the first time?
Maybe it was in Portuguese Bend.
Here's my, like, 5-year-old memory of meeting you. We were in the pool. Alex and I had matching swim trunks.
Right.
These tight, like, bicycle pants with gold buckles on it. And we were, you know, this is how, this is during our leisure time in our matching bathing suits. And everybody was very excited about you and John coming over. Mom was kind of nervous. And was telling us about, you know, we're going to meet John's wife. I'm meeting you. And John says, Griffin, you got a little something poking out of there. And I look down and one ball has come out of the seam that was broken in the tight bathing suit. And Dad and John, and I think my mom, roared with laughter. And I was scarlet. I was so embarrassed. And you were the only one that didn't laugh. You were like, you just kept right on going, just like with a totally straight face. I always loved you for that.
That was my guest, Griffin.
You should see my smile just remembering that.
Yeah, it's such an intimate moment. You and your aunt, you're sitting side by side together. I was also thinking about, I mean, why this moment is forever cemented in your mind. What was it about that moment of meeting and the way Joan reacted to that embarrassing situation that sticks with you?
Because, you know, it became emblematic of the kind of person she's known for as a writer. But in my mind, at that time, having never read her, she was a person who didn't go with the crowd, did not join the laughter of adults toward a little boy. She saw it differently, and she looked at me through these big sunglasses, and you know, she was not that much taller than me either, and I felt this unbelievable connection. And she seemed, the subtext between us was like going, I'm not with those guys. I'm right here.
Well, Griffin, thank you for allowing us into your family's life and your story.
Thank you very much, Sonia.
Griffin Dunn recorded last year. His book, The Friday Afternoon Club, A Family Memoir, is now out in paperback. Coming up, our TV critic David Bianculli remembers the musical satirist Tom Lehrer, who died last week. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Tom Lehrer, the composer and occasional performer of such satirical, often topical songs like Pollution and Vatican Rag, died last week at the age of 97. Our TV critic David Bianculli notes that for the vast majority of those years, Tom Lehrer was not a performer. He was a professor teaching mathematics at Harvard and MIT. But his songs, mostly from the 1950s and 60s, were not forgotten. Here's David's remembrance.
See, the halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. A fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly. But they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste.
Tom Lehrer was born in New York City in 1928. As a youngster, he had a fondness and an aptitude for both music and math. He loved logic puzzles and also took classical piano lessons. But he preferred the comic operettas of Gilbert and Sullivan, the songs of Cole Porter, and the tongue-twisting vocal performances by Danny Kaye. He attended the same summer camp as another puzzle and music enthusiast, Stephen Sondheim. But they didn't get to know each other until almost 60 years later. In a rare 1997 interview, Lehrer called Sondheim, quote, the greatest lyricist that the English language has ever produced, unquote, and went on to add, and that's a fact, not an opinion. Tom Lehrer, like Sondheim, was precocious at a young age, skipping enough grades to enter Harvard University at age 15. He settled on the study of mathematics, but began writing songs for the amusement of his classmates, performing occasionally at school shows and at local clubs. In 1953, while still a graduate student, he paid $15 for an hour of time at a Boston recording studio. When the hour was up, he had recorded enough of his own comic compositions to fill an album. He called it Songs by Tom Lehrer and printed 400 copies. Demand eventually called for a second pressing, then a third. And over the decades, Lehrer's albums have sold in the millions. Here's a taste from that first homemade record, a love song called I Hold Your Hand in Mine.
I hold your hand in mine, dear. I press it to my lips. I take a healthy bite from your dainty fingers. My joy would be complete, dear, if you were only here. But still I keep your hand as a precious souvenir.
In the mid-50s, Tom Lehrer booked a few appearances where he sang his old and new songs, accompanying himself on piano. But he also found time to graduate from Harvard, attend grad school, spend 2 years in the Army, and begin teaching math courses at both Harvard and MIT. Meanwhile, Mad Magazine started featuring and illustrating his lyrics. 6 years after his first album, Tom Lehrer added to his discography, releasing both studio and live recordings of such songs as this one. We Will All Go Together When We Go, a little ditty about the impending threat of global nuclear annihilation.
We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. You will all go directly to your respective Valhallas. Go directly, do not pass, go, do not collect $200. And we will all...
Lehrer's pop culture profile and his visibility peaked in the mid-60s. His compositions were featured on NBC's That Was the Week That Was, the American version of a satirical British show, both of which were hosted by David Frost. But Lehrer never appeared on NBC's show to sing them himself. He just supplied them, to be sung by Nancy Ames, Phyllis Newman, and others. While he was recording and performing, Lehrer also was teaching. In his concerts and his recordings, he introduced each song like a teacher, with a mini-lecture putting it in context. That certainly has helped his songs stay alive over the decades. And on the recordings, you can hear how much he values both his diction, every word, whether spoken or sung, is enunciated perfectly, and his dictionary. Here's a great example. A song he says he didn't even submit to That Was the Week That Was because he knew it would be rejected. And you can hear from the audience reaction just how shocked and delighted they were by its aggressive irreverence.
Another big news story of the year concerned the Ecumenical Council in Rome, known as Vatican II. Among the things they did, in an attempt to make the church more commercial, was to introduce the vernacular into portions of the Mass to replace Latin and to widen somewhat the range of music permissible in the liturgy. But I feel that if they really want to sell the product in this secular age, what they ought to do is to redo some of the liturgical music in popular song forms. I have a modest example here. It's called The Vatican Rag. First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican Rag.
He enjoyed writing and recording, but not performing. And his most prominent TV appearances weren't even in America. After That Was the Week That Was, he reteamed with David Frost for the BBC's The Frost Report, appearing each week on the same show whose other performers and writers included all the future British members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And Tom Lehrer's last TV performance was on Denmark TV, a full-length one-man show for a student association in Copenhagen. And after that 1967 concert, he retired from show business, resurfacing in the 1970s only for an occasional political fundraiser or to provide an educational song or two for the electric company.
Who can turn a can into a cane? Who can turn a pan into a pane? It's not too hard to see, it's silent E.
But from 1970 until his death in 2025, Tom Lehrer was a math teacher, not a musical satirist. That's more than half a century, and that's how he saw himself. Yet a Rhino CD box set, The Remains of Tom Lehrer, collected plenty of songs to prove that Tom Lehrer was a wonderful songwriter as well. And that's a fact, not an opinion. To close this appreciation, here's one of the last songs he wrote for one of Garrison Keillor's radio shows in 1990. Tom Lehrer didn't perform it then, but recorded it later. The idea was to provide a Jewish counterpart to such Christmas classics as White Christmas. And his title? I'm Spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica.
But in December, there's just one place for me. Amid the California flora, I'll be lighting my menorah like a baby
in his cradle. I'll be playing with my dreidel. Here's to Judas Maccabeus. Boy, if he could only see us spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica by the sea.
David Bianculli teaches television studies at Rowan University. Tom Lehrer died last week at the age of 97. On the next Fresh Air, Scott Anderson chronicles the Iranian Revolution of 1979, the upheaval that deposed the reigning monarch and transformed the country from a U.S. ally to an Islamic republic. He says blunders by American policymakers played a key role in the outcome. I hope you can join us. To keep up with what's on the show and get highlights of our interviews, follow us on Instagram at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sam Brigger is our managing producer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Monique Nazareth, Thea Challoner, Susan Yakundi, Anna Bauman, and John Sheehan. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Hope Wilson is our consulting visual producer. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. With Terry Gross, I'm Tanya Mosley.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.